I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Patty Nemi was told when she was a young girl trying out for the school band that she scored in the 99th percentile for rhythm and the first percentile for melody. It's a good thing she chose to play drums. Since 1992, she's been a percussionist with the San Francisco Opera Orchestra. She writes in her memoir, Sticking It Out, about the thousands of hours she spent practicing while a student at Juilliard, her nearly debilitating anxiety about auditioning, and her passion for percussion. Well, I sit in the balcony at the Kimmel Center and have a perfect view of Christopher Devini. He's been a principal percussionist with the Philadelphia Orchestra since 2003. He and Patty are a couple, and they join us on Radio Times to talk about being a percussionist, what it's like playing in an orchestra, the stress of auditions, and practicing. Patty Nemi, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And Christopher Devini, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
So let's go back. You're a little girl. You're trying out for the band. What were your hopes and dreams back then?
I think I wanted to do it right from the beginning. I was 10, and I just wanted to show off as much as possible. That's why percussion appealed to me. It was as loud as I could play and as show off as I could be. So,
were you a regular show off kid or just on the drums?
I kind of was a show off kid to begin with, so it started that way.
You said I loved music before percussion came along. I didn't play favorites. I liked it if I felt it. Some songs on the radio made me happy. Some made me sad. Music was the simplest way to feel something.
Yes. Yeah, I just liked music, period.
And as a little girl, was there a lot of music in your house?
It was very encouraged. As soon as I started playing, my parents were both incredibly supportive. They were happy to hear me practice all the time, which sounds unusual, hearing a drummer practice.
I was going to say, that's really loud, isn't it?
It can be very loud, but they loved it right from the beginning.
So
they
both
encouraged it.
You were, what, 10 when you started playing the drums then?
Yes, 10.
And haven't looked back?
Nope.
And expanded into other instruments as well. How about for you, Chris? How young were you when you started playing?
My mother and grandmother would say that I was a toddler pulling out pots and pans in the kitchen with wooden spoons. But formally school band also around seventh grade. And
drums? Did you start with drums?
Yes. I tried trombone. My arms couldn't reach seventh position. I gave that up. I tried guitar, but I didn't practice enough to develop calluses, and that got to be, you know, wimply painful. So I gave that up. And I did play piano as well. So that translated into mallet instruments, side of percussion instruments. And percussion in the school band program in North Carolina.
Was it unusual? What is this, the 70s, Patty, for a girl to be playing drums?
It was. I was the only one for a long time, right at the beginning. By the time I was in youth orchestra, it was not so unusual. My teacher in Rochester, New York, growing up, was a woman, which was wonderful. I had this role model that it never occurred to me that this was something I could not do. But it was unusual for a while.
Did people say, well, girls don't play drums kind of thing?
I got that comment occasionally, but no one I took seriously.
There you go.
However, though, I should
go
say,
ahead.
We first only became aware of each other when we were both in the finals of the Boston Symphony Orchestra audition. We both lost. and that was my first experience of running into a female percussionist that was on such a high level. So
that was 1990.
Yeah, and so that is, or back then at least, was an unusual occurrence.
You know, I mentioned the fact that I go to the orchestra and I watch you, Chris, and other members of the percussion. I have a really good view of what the percussionists are doing. Clearly multi-instrumentalists. There's a lot of watching and waiting and listening. I find it fascinating watching certain members of the percussion part of the orchestra, just waiting for that moment when they're going to hit the triangle, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of our life. Yes,
it's what we do best, waiting.
Waiting and watching. Yeah. And so what are you doing while you're waiting and watching?
Well, you can go.
I think we hope just to pay attention, just keep paying attention. You get used to it. You get good at what you do. And we do wait a lot. So there's a lot of waiting, and waiting tends to exacerbate anxiety sometimes. If you're thinking about what's hard to come up, you're trying not to think about how hard it is. But you just get really good at concentrating through that period of time, listening to the music, enjoying what's going on.
I do want to get to the anxiety part because you write a lot about that. But how about for you, Chris?
The waiting usually involves using your ears and really listening to all of the sounds that are around you, all the different choirs in the orchestra, the different textures. The instruments we play are not the primary colors. You know, those are strings. Right. And even woodwinds and brass. The percussion, to me, as I've always said, are more like the splash of chartreuse here and there. And so we have to think about that, how we can augment in a good, in a positive way, whatever is already established primarily by the other instruments. But, you know, what would paintings be without, if there was only the primary colors?
Well, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You do, as I mentioned, Patty, you do write a lot about the kind of anxiety that you've had to deal with as a professional musician. Do you think it's unusual? Is there something unique about your kind of anxiety about performance or even about thinking about performance?
I don't think so. I think a lot of people, musicians and non-musicians, have dealt with anxiety. Maybe it's just that I wrote a lot about it. But it's one of the things that, if people read the book, talk to me the most about.
Do they?
Is their issues with anxiety. So it's nice to know I'm certainly not alone. But at the time, and I wrote about this, at the time I went to Juilliard, it was something we didn't talk about. And I think it was embarrassment. I was certainly embarrassed how badly it affected me.
I mean, are we talking performance anxiety, the idea of anticipating something that could happen in a performance?
Yes, exactly. You start to think
about...
It's
like your mind gets ahead of yourself?
Yes. And thinking about those things is the worst thing you can do. You don't want to imagine catastrophes, but I was great at doing that, imagining the catastrophes. So not thinking about it is thinking about it.
Of course, exactly. For a while, I don't know if you still do, and I've heard of musicians taking things like Inderol.
Yes.
I mean, ways of dealing with some of the anxiety. How did that help you?
It's miraculous at first because it takes away the thought that your hands are going to shake. So it takes that out of the equation. So initially, it helps quite a bit because that's all I was worried about. Are my hands going to shake? Well, no, they're not anymore.
Right.
But after a while, you start to think about other catastrophes. Am I going to have a memory slip? Am I, you know, just going to fall down on the job at this part? Am I not going to come in the right place? So unfortunately, you start to think about other things that can happen.
So do you still take Inderol?
Yes, I do when I need to.
When you know you've got a big performance or, I don't know, do you still audition for things?
No. And that was...
She says with a great deal of relief.
Yes. Auditions are well behind me, but that's the time I took it the most because auditions are really, really tough. But if there's a big performance, I will still take it.
Yeah. Is that unusual, do you think, Grissom, among musicians?
To take Inderol?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so at all. It is somewhat stigmatic, and some people don't want to talk about that. I talk about it with my students that I teach. Some are looking for solutions to shaking, physical manifestations of their anxiety that only occur at an audition, wouldn't occur in a practice room, wouldn't occur with the performance of a regular ensemble. However, when you're on stage by yourself, even the audition process itself is really pretty quite different than the actual job.
It's brutal. Yeah. It's
because
brutal.
Because you're obviously competing for, one or two spots potentially, or maybe even one spot, just the high level of competition.
Yeah, and the rarity of auditions coming up. It can be one, two auditions a year, and that's a good year.
Yeah.
And one person will get the job, and there are probably about 75 other competitors there.
At least, yeah. And you know, as you know from coming to the orchestra, there's a large group of people on stage most of the time, upwards of 90 to 100 people. And all of a sudden, that same repertoire is put under a gigantic microscope, and it's just you.
Yeah.
That,
all alone.
That dynamic is radically different than anything you even prepared for. So it's not uncommon that you would have these side effects from that experience at the audition.
But is it the physical shaking, or is it the kind of mental gymnastics or catastrophizing that you describe, Patty?
For me, it was everything. But Inderol is the best thing to help with the physical shaking. You know, your heart won't jump out of your skin and your hands won't shake so hard that you can't play.
Do you ever do meditation or things like
that? I've done a lot of things, yes.
Have you? To sort of quiet your mind?
Yes. For me, none of that helped enough. But still working, still trying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess because musicians, it's a high wire act in many ways. But
yes.
I mean, anxiety is, I think most people can relate to what we're talking about to some degree or another. You also talk, Patty, about perfectionism.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, as a high-level musician, that is the goal. Is it
yes.
attainable?
It's not attainable. You can get as close as you can. But perfectionism, I think, is another reason we get so anxious. We spend a lot of our practice time criticizing ourselves. You have to. You're in the practice room hours a day by yourself, and your job is to get better. The only way to do that is to point out your own flaws. And you can constructively criticize yourself, but all those hours doing that and then walk out the practice room door, stand on stage, and have the confidence to feel great about what you're doing when you've previously spent all those hours
beating
yourself.
Well, let me quote something you hear. Despite the angst it produced, having perfection as a goal was liberating. There was no ambiguity involved in this pursuit. This idea that perfection was attainable started to dribble into the few areas of my life that did not involve music. And you talk about perfection and control.
Yes. Yeah, I think they go together quite well.
How so?
If you feel that perfection is your goal, and in music, sometimes it feels like you can attain that goal. The only way to do that is to control every aspect of your practice life, of your preparation for auditions. And control is, I think they go hand in hand. They certainly did for me.
Will you describe even being a bit of a neat freak? Is that okay?
Oh, yes. Certainly.
I mean, the idea of sort of having everything in its place, including your room as a kid growing up, right?
Yeah, folding garbage, which sounds ridiculous, but it, you know, to me, it made perfect sense. Fold the garbage in the garbage can. So I think I came by the anxiety, honestly. It started then.
Trying to imagine what a folded piece of garbage looks like in the garbage can. I guess it looks lovely, right?
I think my parents would remember that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they do.
Yeah. Do you do that anymore?
No. I've improved.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Patty Neamy, and she's written a memoir about her life as a musician. It's called Sticking It Out, From Juilliard to the Orchestra Pit, a percussionist's memoir. And she is a member of the percussion section of the San Francisco Opera Orchestra. We invited her partner to join us here on Radio Times, Christopher Deviney. He is the Philadelphia Orchestra principal percussionist. Both of them joining us today on Radio Times, talking about their life as a musician and also some of the anxieties that they've had to experience and overcome for things like auditioning, all of that. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Patty Neamy and Christopher Deviney about being percussionists. Here's Patty Neamy playing the solo xylophone part in the performance of Whirlwind. This is from 1993 in Davies Symphony Hall, and this is the final minute of the song. Thank you. Beautiful.
Thank you.
How do you like listening to yourself?
I like listening to that.
Yeah, that's pretty good, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah, that was fun to play.
And how much practice went into that? Is there any way to calculate that?
It's hard to calculate. That's kind of a lifetime of practice because all the practicing we do goes into every performance. But I would say specifically for that, I probably started a good 3 or 4 months before, really doing it slowly. We love slow practice. That's the best thing you can do. You don't incorporate mistakes into slow practicing. You shouldn't. So maybe 3 or 4 months, I would say, specifically on that.
And as a percussionist, I mean, is there an instrument that you feel like is either your favorite or the one that you feel the most connected to?
I love to play cymbals.
I think that's the big crash.
Yep. And playing an opera, when you play cymbals, there are usually so many people joining you, a whole full stage chorus, the entire orchestra, and singers are loud. They are really loud.
Especially louder than when a cymbal?
I think so, yeah. They are loud. They can just belt it out and bury us if they want to. So it's fun to be a part of that noise, all that noise together. It's really a lot of fun.
And how about for you, Chris? Is there a favorite instrument?
My pat answer is whatever I'm playing currently.
Truly?
You know, whatever instrument. But I love to play any mallet instruments specifically. Percussionists these days, I think, gravitate towards one particular instrument called a marimba, which is like an oversized xylophone. And the resonant nature of it is very expressive. And it's got a very unique sound, totally different than any other percussion instrument.
You're right. This book is really about going to Juilliard in many ways. And I mean, it seems, and perhaps this is not surprising, a kind of sink or swim place, at least when you were there. I don't know if it's any different today, but essentially you were on your own.
Yes. Yeah. No dorms at the time, which I really appreciated, actually, because I felt like you really had to just do everything on your own. And if you couldn't do that, you probably shouldn't be in music anyway.
Really?
Because so much of it is self-promotion, self-propulsion, let's say. No one's telling you, get in a practice room and practice. If you're not willing to do that and or looking forward to it, you probably won't be doing that kind of music anyway.
I mean, it sounded like most of the time at Juilliard was then practicing.
Yes.
And then playing for your various teachers, yes?
Playing for teachers, playing for colleagues, playing an orchestra. That's what we did there.
So how many hours a day basically practicing, you think, when you were at Juilliard?
It wouldn't be unusual to practice for 6 hours a day. It wasn't unusual to play much longer than that because we would have percussion ensemble or have a lesson or have orchestra rehearsals. So playing hours and hours a day.
And did you enjoy the practicing?
I loved practicing. Some people do, some don't, but I love to practice. It was like a big puzzle, I thought.
Ah.
How do you figure out how to get better? It's all up to you, really. A lot of it is up to you.
So when you were practicing, you weren't feeling anxious?
Nope.
You were actually enjoying yourself?
I was enjoying it, yeah. I liked the process. The process was thrilling. It was a real process of discovery.
Which is what? Breaking down a piece into its parts and putting it back together and sort of understanding how the music fits together?
Even more elemental than that, just how do I play? What do I need to do to win a job? And how do I get those parts together? How do I play a snare drum roll? Something as simple as that. How do you make a great snare drum roll better?
How about for you, Chris? What's your approach to practicing?
Same thing, really. I think that's something all musicians share in common is that attaining that goal, obviously we'd like to be working. And professionally speaking, that comes down to, at least in the orchestral field, to winning an audition. It's the process that everyone has to become familiar with and get better at navigating through. And it's kind of like the quote of, you know, democracy is the worst form of government in the world except for all the others.
Right.
That's kind of how auditions are too. There's just no other system because of time factors to determine how to hire somebody. And so we all had become very familiar with that.
And where did you go to school?
Florida State University for my undergrad. I came here to Philadelphia to Temple University to study with Alan Abel, who was also in the Philadelphia Orchestra, for my master's degree. And then I left after that and through a series of smaller to bigger to ultimately the job that I have now in the Philadelphia Orchestra.
And do you like practicing?
I like practicing. I try to make it so that I so I can tolerate it. I don't know that
Now,
I have
what does that mean?
Well, I don't know that I have the same enthusiasm for practicing that Patty said, but if I can find ways to make sure that I can at least tolerate it, then that'll keep me in the practice room. That's my goal, is to stay in the practice room, because only positive things can happen if you stay in the practice room, and only negative things can happen if you leave the practice room.
Right.
So the idea is to stay.
And just, again, Patty, as you write about Juilliard, and there should be no surprises here, just how competitive it was, how difficult it was, I mean, for lack of a better word. I mean, just feeling as if, in a sense, what, your future was on the line?
It felt like that. It felt like there was a real time limit. I always had the idea that this could not go on forever. You don't practice till you're 50 and then get a job. There are some people who do that, but I didn't think that was going to be the case. It felt like there was a time limit. I needed to practice all the time and get out there and do it.
You have a section in the book where you talk about, I guess, the difference between talent and hard work. I mean, it seemed that people were telling you in different kinds of ways that perhaps there were people with more, quote unquote, talent, but you had this ability to work hard.
Yes, and that's not to take away from people who, you know, if they're told they're talented, there are plenty of people who work hard. And ultimately, if you don't work hard, nothing good will happen.
Right.
But I think for me, I always felt like it was a little bit harder. I was very tense and anxious, so it was a little bit harder than for some people. But all of us have to work hard. Nothing will happen without that.
But listening to that piece that you just played, I mean, there's a lot of talent there, isn't there?
A lot of slow practicing.
A lot of slow practicing.
Yes.
How do you see this sort of hard work talent mix?
Well, my audition story was long and arduous. I took 30 auditions over the course of my life. Yeah, and that's 30 times where you pay for hotel and airfare and time away from whatever you were doing to make ends meet at the time. And that's a lot of rejection, honestly. So I also felt, as she said, growing up, that there were people that were more quick to digest material than I was, had more natural ability than it seemed like I had. But I think the equalizing factor is, if you're willing to work hard, you can always overcome that with that kind of effort.
Right. And not afraid of rejection, like you say.
Yeah.
It's going to happen.
I mean, is it developing a thick skin? Is it, I mean, 30 rejections or 29 rejections for you, Chris? How about, I mean, who's counting? But how do you deal with that and go on? And I know there were times where you just felt like, I can't do this anymore.
I think you have to have the view that rejection is a good thing. And it was the same process writing a book. I sent off many, many queries.
Did
and
you?
Got a lot of rejections. So if you view rejection as a gift, this is saying, I need to make this better. Something needs to be better. And I think we both have that, just the idea that rejection right. is a tool. It's not that it doesn't get hard. There were times I thought, I don't know if I can do this. But those went away quickly.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's a great way to think about rejection. We've all had to deal with
yes.
it in our own kind of way, which is somebody's telling me something important that I need to understand.
Right. I never saw a rejection at an audition as a way to say that they're wrong necessarily. I definitely wanted to feel confident enough to say, well, they missed an opportunity to hire a good musician.
Of course.
But I mostly took away from the rejection, okay, well, what do I need to do better next time?
Yeah. Yes.
Let me get to, it looks like Rhonda from the highway joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Rhonda. Go ahead. You're on the air. We have Rhonda. Okay, go ahead, Rhonda.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
When my husband and I go to the Philadelphia Orchestra, and I watch the percussionist Austin, and being a musician myself, I have to count a lot. I'm wondering if the percussionists wait for a particular spot in the piece of music and then begin counting, or are you counting the entire time?
Go ahead. You want to take that, Patty, and then we'll throw it to you, Chris.
That's a good question, and it's a combination of both. Sometimes you just need to sit and literally count the whole time. Other times there are cues that happen within the orchestra, and the best thing you can do is combine both of them. Have cues written in your part. This person is coming in at this moment. And in a in an orchestra like the Philadelphia Orchestra, you're not going to have too many times where someone doesn't come in. So you can pretty much rely on everybody else to tell you where you are in the piece.
Yes, the parts are riddled with instrumental cues of different moments within the music that you listen for, cadences, conclusions of phrases, that kind of thing. And but then every now and then there's counting from 1 to 64 or whatever.
Oh,
it is.
Oh, is that right? You know, yeah. I mean, have there been times in your careers where just – the orchestra was just off, or the conductor was just off, and you're on and they're off, and you're trying to figure it out how to fit it all together, Patty?
Absolutely. There are a lot of times where you have to decide what's going to happen, especially, I would say, in opera, because there are so many more moving parts. There are literally hundreds of people. So there are times you might have to decide who are you going to go with. And that happens, and that can be kind of funny sometimes.
Funny for who?
Not funny when it's happening.
No.
But
no.
Funny later when you're recounting what just happened.
And for opera, how much of a rehearsal do you – I mean, once – you know, let's say it's the opera's going to open in San Francisco where you play – are there weeks of rehearsals, a couple of days of rehearsals?
They're spread out over the course of weeks, but I would say most operas have about 7-8 rehearsals before we put a show on.
Wow. And as you say, all those moving parts to get them all moving together.
Yeah. That's just for orchestra. Just orchestra rehearsals. The singers are rehearsing by themselves. The chorus is rehearsing by themselves. There are a lot of separate rehearsals going on prior to that.
To me, not knowing about opera, but going out to San Francisco and seeing these productions also from day one until they're actually up and running, it's even more impressive of a machine, because they're not just doing one opera. They're doing a series of usually three different operas at the same time. So they're coordinating rehearsals for three different productions, all interworking, rotating around each other, and it's quite impressive.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Christopher DeVinny. He's Philadelphia Orchestra Principal Percussionist. Also with us is Patty Neamy, member of the percussion section of the San Francisco Opera Orchestra. They are a couple. And Patty's written a book called Sticking It Out, From Juilliard to the Orchestra Pit, a Percussionist Memoir. And you can join our conversation calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Patty, you write about a teacher you had at Juilliard, a guy named Richard, or you call him Richard in the book, who in hindsight, and I guess as it was happening, not only did he say, but he was in love with you, but he was also sexually harassing you, and you were how old at the time?
21.
21. There's what happened in real time, and then there's what happened as you look back on it.
Yes.
In real time, what was the effect on you?
It produced a great deal of anxiety for me. I felt there were only two poor choices, one of which was – like I said, because this happened prior to Anita Hill, it didn't quite occur to me what was going on, except that it produced a lot of anxiety. But one of the choices would have been to say, wow, this is very uncomfortable, I'm going to switch teachers, which would have had effects. And the other choice was to just take it on myself and eventually get an ulcer like I did, and just sort of stomach literally the whole thing. So I felt like I had two bad choices.
And no one knew about it, or did anyone – was anyone – I mean, it sounded like a lot of what happened was either at dinner or in a practice room somewhere.
Right.
So there were not a lot of outside observers.
Not at all. And music conservatories, unfortunately, that's part of it, is our lessons are one-on-one. So it's a kind of a setup for that in some ways. I think it was pretty frequently happening.
Do you?
Yes.
And not talked about?
Not talked about.
How about now, do you think?
Now, I think it probably happens quite a bit still, but at least there's more information. It's talked about. It's very clearly understood that it's not supposed to be happening. And that wasn't even something that I was sure about at the time.
You mentioned Anita Hill, and until the weekend of testimony, did you have a name for what was happening to you? Did you know? Did you think you were being sexually harassed?
No, that's a good point. Because it wasn't physical harassment, I didn't even know what it was. I couldn't have put a name to it. And I thought, well, this is uncomfortable, but what is it? I just tried not to think about it most of the time. But that was the gift from Anita Hill, is that there was a name. It happened to a lot of other women, and we could talk about it. Now I could say, oh, yeah, this was about power. This was not because it was not physical, I thought, well, okay, maybe there's nothing wrong. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I heard her talk, I thought, this is about power and it's wrong.
Do you think he really was in love with you, or do you think it was about power and control?
I don't know. The power I mean is that he had power over me, period. He was a mentor and a teacher. So,
and it sounds like, I mean, it sounds like you had some anxiety anyway, but then this just compounded how you were feeling. And you mentioned an ulcer and all of that.
Yeah, it just made it a lot worse. And fortunately, New World Symphony came along at that time, so I was able to leave with a good place to go to.
New World Symphony is a training orchestra down in Miami, Florida. Started by Michael Tilson Thomas, still continues today. A lot of great players get professional jobs from that training orchestra, but Patty was in the first class of that.
Yeah. I do want to talk about that because that also sounded like a pretty wild experience down there. So what was it like writing about this? As you said, this was something you had kept to yourself.
Writing about the sexual harassment specifically? It was hard to know. Like I said, I would like to be fair to him in that nobody was talking about it. So he didn't have the benefit of these discussions either. So we were both kind of equally at sea about it. I'd like to think, you know, teachers at that age would know better, but it wasn't talked about. So I had to be fair about that. And other than that, I just tried to write exactly what happened.
Well, and I mentioned this before going on the air, this, you do describe him, and I would assume if someone went to Juilliard, they probably know who you're talking about.
Yes. Yeah, they probably do.
And you're okay with that? Or they're okay with that?
I think I had to be. That's just how it went.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, talking with Patty Niemi and Christopher Divini. We are talking about being a percussionist. Patty Niemi is a member of the percussion section of the San Francisco Opera Orchestra. Her book is Sticking It Out. And Christopher Divini, Philadelphia Orchestra principal percussionist. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Here's Christopher Divini performing with the Westchester University Percussion Ensemble, G.H. Green's Valse Brillante on November 20th, 2012. Bravo.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, lovely. I love the sound of the xylophone. I mean, we heard from you, Patty, and from you, Chris. There's something about, I don't even know what I love about it, but there's something about just how it sounds.
The xylophone was actually one of the first instruments that actually came very well, was heard very well in early recording technology. That's why those pieces that were vintage 20s and 30s were kind of the golden era of that instrument, the xylophone, because they recorded very well and you could hear them on early disc recordings. So there was a whole body of repertoire that developed at that time because it was a very popular instrument to listen to, mostly because you could hear it.
Hard to play, though?
Oh, yeah.
It's unforgiving.
Very unforgiving.
We've been talking about perfection. You have to be sort of perfect.
Yes.
Yeah. Where you hit exactly right.
Yeah, there's a note that's right or wrong. It's not. There's no question. If you hit the right note, it's right. If you don't, it's wrong. It's not a little bit wrong.
Let me get some callers in. We've got, looks like Mike from Philadelphia. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Hi there. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, it's Miles.
Miles, go ahead, Miles. Sorry.
Center City. That's all right. I do a lot of freelancing in the area and often play a lot of contemporary music. And it seems like composers writing for contemporary music really are fascinated by the percussion and use a lot of it. And I'm amazed the percussionists who do this work have to do these huge setups where they bring a lot of instruments in. And setting up is like, gosh, being a mover, you know, it's a lot of hard physical labor, just getting the instruments in place and, you know, in an arrangement that works. And then that I'm always amazed because they go from that kind of work in an instant to having to play and using the most delicate kind of small motor skills. And I can't imagine having to do that sort of combination
sure.
of hard labor and then you know.
That's an interesting way the way that you put it, Miles. Patty, you want to respond to that?
That's a good point because it is like being a furniture mover. Contemporary music is the hardest to collect all the instruments you need, get them all together, move them where they need to go, set them up, and then, like you said, use your fine motor skills to play. And then break it down and take it all home.
Yeah, he's absolutely right. That's a very valid point. And composers consider percussion to be kind of the last frontier in utilizing sounds. So new sounds are going to come more than likely from the percussion section because they haven't been utilized before. You know, the percussion, right. we don't have a history of like string instruments or even woodwind or brass instruments. Ours is more recent. But we have more instruments, more sound colors to choose from. Composers like to utilize that, and that usually means a truck full of gear to haul right. around and move and manipulate.
So are we in a kind of a golden age for percussion?
There's a lot of great music being written.
Thinking about all this contemporary music that is using this palette of sound?
Yes, absolutely.
Let me get John from Baltimore to join us on Radio Times. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I like to describe myself as a recovering cellist. And my specific question is, how do you balance the drive for perfection with enjoying the moment? More specifically, towards the end of my bachelor's, I know a lot of my colleagues, a lot of people in my studio, we just didn't really enjoy playing anymore because we were just trying so hard to be perfect. Mm.
Oh, it's such a great question, John. Patty, I'm going to toss it to you.
That's a good question. It's the process is very different from playing music is. So the process is years and years of practicing and telling yourself how to get better. And then playing music is putting it all together. For me, when I most enjoy music is if I have something, like I said before, like a cymbal part, where I'm just a part of the whole. I'm a cog in the wheel, so I get to enjoy listening to the music and playing at the same time.
How about for you, Chris?
I try to remind my students to remind themselves. Essentially, I have to do the same thing. That's the thing I love most about teaching is teaching to me is bringing up the things that I actually need to concentrate on myself.
Oh, that's right.
It doesn't make any sense to me to tell a student to do something and me not follow the same advice. And part of that advice is to remember to take a step back and remember why you're doing it and try to enjoy it. Try to find the things in what you're doing that are enjoyable. Not everything is. Very few things in life are always enjoyable.
Sure.
So even the work and the profession that you chose, parts of that are not going to be enjoyable. But you can remind yourself of what you do like about it and try to focus on that. But that takes a little bit of will to remember that sometimes because you can get caught up in just the routine of it.
Sure, sure. And those voices in our head that are saying all sorts of things to us. An email from Thomas, would they be less anxious if auditions use blind reviews behind curtains? Some groups use behind the curtains auditions to avoid biases. Would that help with anxiety too?
Most auditions are blind at this point.
Oh, interesting.
A lot of them start off blind, like let's say for the prelims and the semis, they would be blind. Sometimes in the finals, you will see who you're dealing with, who the auditionees are. But I don't think it makes it less anxiety provoking because it's still the feeling that these come up so rarely, these auditions, and it's my one chance.
for me, I always felt that when the screen was up, that there's some kind of, you know, three-headed monster on the other side. When the screen right. came down, oftentimes I knew a face with a name. You know, the percussion world is quite small. It's really not that big. But, you know, just through the rosters of symphony orchestra personnel, I could probably determine when the screen came down who was listening to me based on the years of service they had had in the orchestra and their age and so forth. I was like, oh, that's probably this person or that probably. Well, the name associated with a face made it less nerve-wracking for me. When the screen was up, I was actually more nervous.
Thanks for that comment. Patty, one of the things that you write in this book is, and I'm quoting here, we struggle to play well in spite of the conductor. That's a loaded loaded sentence there, but it's in there and you mean it. I mean, they're
not always.
What are you telling us?
It's sometimes it's very hard to deal with conductors. Many times they're fantastic, and those conductors are wonderful for us. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're not good, and wow, it takes a lot of skill to figure out what to do about that. It brings us together as musicians, my colleagues and I, you know, it brings us together trying to figure out how to work around this. And as you move up the food chain, when you get to better and better orchestras, it happens less frequently, certainly. But there are some legendary tough ones out there.
And is it that they don't know what they're doing, or they haven't done their homework, they haven't done their practicing, or there's something off, or chemistry with the orchestra?
Chemistry, and usually it has to do with personality. It's very rarely about technique, because the technical side of conducting is not difficult. That's what the audience sees, is the traffic cop version. You know, they're just trying to keep things together. But the hard work is done in the rehearsals before then. They're the interpreter. They're the conduit between the composer and how it sounds when you're done. So they're interpreting everything. They're interpreting tempo. They're interpreting balance, intonation. They're up there trying to tell us how to make this better. We are their instrument. So if there's a personality issue, that can really get in the way.
You describe a conductor who really called you out. I mean, at some point in your career, I mean, just stopped the rehearsal and pointed at you.
Yeah, well, there was one time when I was at Interlock, and so I was young, I was in high school, and that felt really bad because he called me out sort of personally. It's one thing to be told do something differently because that's their job, and that's never personal. But when they start attacking you personally, that doesn't feel good at all.
Do you want to comment on this at all, Chris? We struggle to play well in spite of the conductor?
The conductor definitely has an aspect of the traffic cop in performance, but I agree with Patty that most of the work is done in rehearsals that the audience never really sees. And I also agree that it's less of an issue up the food chain. That's a good way to put that.
Mm-hmm.
Rarely is it that you come in and you play everything exactly how you think it should go and everything's great and the conductor thinks everything you did was wonderful. So you better be ready to be able to adjust and adapt, because sure enough, somebody's going to be asked to do something different, and it's nothing more awkward for a whole orchestra to sit there and watch one colleague who doesn't have the ability to adapt very well while that conductor says, no, that's not what I want.
Yikes.
I want you to do it different.
No.
And they can't do it different. And so that's something that I spend a lot of time with my students on, trying to get mm-hmm. them to be aware of adaptability.
Well, as someone who's gone to the orchestra a lot and with different conductors who come in, it is possible to be a member of the audience and just to see the chemistry or feel the chemistry between a conductor and the orchestra. And it varies. I mean, it feels like, oh, they're just totally in sync, and sometimes
And that's
not
kind
so much.
Of almost unexplainable sometimes, even for us as musicians. I mean, someone would say, well, why is this person or this conductor better than the other? And it's almost kind of like I can't really tell you, but there's a connection. And it happened over the course of the rehearsals. Maybe it also then expanded into repeat performances or appearances from year to year. Familiarity.
Do you know each other?
Yeah, exactly. But the actual specifics of why is very hard to nail
down. I've thought about that a lot. One of the specifics I came up with is a conductor who feels very secure in their fundamental choices that they're making. There doesn't need to be a lot of explanation with words. They've made these choices. They're showing it with their hands. That tends to be the better conductors, I think,
don't have to say as much. Yes, the ones who can get all that they need or that they are looking for with just their gestures.
Mm-hmm.
That goes a long way with musicians because it means we don't have to stop and talk. We're not really there to talk. We're there to play.
Yeah.
So that's important.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Christopher DeVinny, and he is the principal percussionist with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Patty Neamy, a member of the percussion section of the San Francisco Opera Orchestra. And Patty's got a new book. It's called Sticking It Out, From Juilliard to the Orchestra Pit, A Percussionist's Memoir. 1-888-477-9499, WHYY.org. And you can also send us an email, radiotimes@WHYY.org. Let me get Zach from Philadelphia. Zach, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, guys.
Hi there.
Great conversation.
Thank you. I never
thought I would be tuning in this morning to hear this sort of... I was privileged to go to Temple and study composition, and I've been a percussionist since I was a kid. Oh. And studied a little bit with Phil and was able to have a triangle lesson with the great Alan Abel is, you know, amazing opportunity. So
great.
I can't say enough about Temple as far as that goes. I know, Christopher, you're at the department now.
Zach, if I can just jump in here, only because we're almost out of time, and if you can ask your question, that'd be great.
Sure. Percussion is so different from all the other instruments, and there's this almost like quasi-philosophical, like Zen-like element to it. There's so much waiting involved. I'm wondering, you know, how that was sort of imparted through teachers. What sort of advice? How did teachers teach you about the thinking about percussion?
Zach, let me pick up. You used the word Zen, which is interesting. I mean, and whether there is, Patty, some kind of Zen quality to being a percussionist.
That usually goes hand in hand with the word waiting, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly.
That's an interesting question that I really didn't think about, is that the waiting, how is it imparted by teachers? I don't remember talking too much about it with them. I think a lot of that was learned on the job.
Yeah, absolutely. But my colleague Don Liuzzi, who plays timpani in the Philadelphia Orchestra, his favorite drawing on a blackboard of a musician is a smiley face with gigantic ears. And that is getting back to what I said before about using your ears.
Zach, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We don't really have time to do justice to the New World Orchestra, but that's where you went in Miami Beach.
New World Symphony, yes.
Yeah, this is Michael Tilson Thomas. He created this. What did you learn there?
Oh, so many things. That was an incredible gift. Another great gift that Michael gave us all was to bring us down there and be a part of that orchestra. It was on-the-job training, and we had the luxury of making mistakes because we were all equals there. It wasn't like one of us came into an orchestra and had to adapt. We were all equals fumbling our way through it.
Students, young kids, right out of college.
Yes.
Wow.
It was an incredible place. It was just wonderful. So we learned a lot of things. We just played all the time.
And that was before Miami Beach became the Miami Beach that we associate with today.
It's funny to hear about Miami Beach now because it's very slick, and it wasn't like that at all. It was a lot of fun. It was really different.
We'll leave it on that note. Patty Neamy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And her book is called Sticking It Out. And Christopher DeVinny, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Maureen.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and you can also sign up for our newsletter and listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.